terminology and definitions are great, often. Specificity can be very useful, mostly, sometimes. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Strict classification can save a lot of time when it comes to mental health. You say anorexia, and people know what that means. You say major depressive disorder, people get it. Sometimes you can even skip past the words and just use acronyms. We say that someone has PTSD or OCD, and people will know what you mean. They'll understand the person you're talking about better. There's a catch, though. Terms and definitions aren't so useful in portraying the full complexity and nuance of a person's brain. You can say someone has an anxiety disorder, but that doesn't cover what that person's life experiences have been. It doesn't shed much light on what they inherited genetically. It doesn't say much about their biology. And that's when we need to tell stories. That's when we need to hear about someone's life, as much of it as we can. And in those stories, we can understand more about the human being and whatever is going on in their minds. We can get where those terms and definitions fit neatly and where they might not fit so well. It's a heavier lift to tell stories. It's a lot more work. And it's even a lot more work to hear stories about someone's full human mental complexity. But that's what's great about books. Rachel Aviv is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and she has a new book, Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. The book is a series of profiles of people with evident mental health issues, including Rachel herself. But in telling the full stories of these people, beyond the terms that a doctor might use, Rachel reveals a lot of the ambiguity that isn't covered by a diagnosis. Rachel Aviv, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thank you.
And let's start right around where you start the book, which is you at age 6. And things weren't maybe typical of what 6 years old looks for a lot of people. What happened when you were around 6?
What I remember is just, I don't remember that much, except that I stopped eating for a few days. And I remember my parents were going through a very complicated divorce at the time. I had just started first grade, and my mom had taken me to our pediatrician, and there was concern because I'd lost a few pounds. And this was the late 80s, and the pediatrician then referred me to the Children's Hospital in Detroit and diagnosed me as anorexic. And it just, this behavior that was sort of childish of not eating and sort of being mopey and expressing a sense of helplessness really quickly got channeled into this formal anorexia diagnosis. And I was hospitalized with older girls who also had anorexia. So there was this little anorexia unit on the floor of the hospital. And I was there for 6 weeks and I didn't see my parents. And it was during that time that I kind of learned what it was to be anorexic. I just had no way, the word meant nothing to me. But slowly I saw these other girls exhibiting these behaviors and sort of started adopting some of them.
Yeah, I saw where you thought anorexia sounded like a type of dinosaur.
Right, right. Like Tyrannosaurus Rex, it had a similar sound.
Right. But this was not a case of you looking through magazines at supermodels and thinking that you needed to have a certain body type, mm-hmm. but you were kind of placed in a community. You were put under the flag of this of this term, anorexia. Mm-hmm. What did you understand it to be?
I guess I started to, older girls would teach me things like, I didn't understand that exercise had anything to do with eating, kind of. I just didn't understand. And they were like, no, you have to do jumping jacks. If you do jumping jacks, then you can lose weight. And they had sort of a whole system of being that related to this goal of being thin or being ascetic. And I kind of absorbed it from them. And my parents were really upset because they didn't have contact with me for the first 2 weeks. And then when they finally started seeing me again, I had sort of embodied anorexia in a way that I had not, like when they had first checked me into the hospital.
It seems like instead of having a support group to get better, you had a support group to get worse.
Right. Yeah. A question for me is, you know, what was I doing, you know, when I was six? Like, what did I think I was doing? And I think when you're young, you don't have that many methods of sort of really getting the attention of adults. And not eating is one of the things you have control over. And that's what I did. And I do remember, like, the adults in my life were quite alarmed, and I was sort of empowered by how alarmed they seemed. Like, I was like, oh, I'm really doing something that's powerful right now. And then it seemed to gain even more power in this new context with these older girls who were doing the same thing. But ultimately, like, I just didn't have the cognitive capacity to understand, like, what a calorie is, or like what that certain foods have more calories. Like, they were just sort of doing this game at a much greater sort of technical skill than I had. I just couldn't understand, like, the rules of that game.
And then how did you get out of this hospital? How did this sort of period of your life come to an end?
It was, you know, I remember, like, there were these rigid rules. If you ate 3 meals in a day, your parents could visit you. And I remember one day I did. It sort of almost randomly, like, I just liked the food I was eating and I, like, kept going. And then once my parents visited me, it was almost like my goals realigned, and I just wanted them to keep visiting me. So in order to do that, I had to just keep eating my meals. And then I was aware that, like, I had to weigh a certain amount to get released from the hospital. And so suddenly just everything shifted for me. And, like, all I wanted to do was be with my family. And so I would, like, eat as much as I could to gain the weight. So I don't quite know what happened. It was like this, it was like I was under the spell of these girls. And then, like, suddenly that was no longer, like, how I was framing my goals.
Well, it seems like the framing is really important here, and kind of the semantic quality of living up to a diagnosis that you've received. This word gets assigned for this complicated state of mind that you're in, and then things start to conform to the term instead of mm-hmm. to the patient, the mm-hmm. kid. And that's a lot of what Strangers to Ourselves is all about, is this idea of the diagnosis and the complexity of the reality. Is there a line between your experience at 6 years old and you writing this book?
Yeah, I think it really helped. You know, I didn't know how to articulate this question I had. And I think it actually wasn't until years later, many, many years later, when I was in my mid-30s, I wrote this story for The New Yorker about children in Sweden from former Soviet states who were applying for asylum to Sweden. And when their applications were denied, they suddenly, like, shut down. They would stop eating. They would lie in bed. And their behavior would gain momentum until suddenly, like, they were almost comatose. And I remember reading a lot at that time about this theory of the looping effect. Ian Hacking, the scholar Ian Hacking, writes about, and the ways in which there's, like, an initial kernel of distress, and then you see how your community responds to that distress. And then that in turn kind of shapes the way you continue to express your distress. And it's like there are certain scripts that illnesses will follow. And I think when I saw that connection, to me, there was something similar to my experience being diagnosed with anorexia and these Swedish children who were diagnosed with this thing called resignation syndrome. And I was struck by how an illness can kind of gain momentum depending on the story that gets told about that illness and the story that a person has about the role of that illness in their life. So I think that became, like, the central question for me, is to think about, you know, there's like that core of suffering or distress, and sort of what is the space between that, like, pure experience and the kind of story that gets told about it, or the way that it's classified. And, you know, sometimes that diagnosis can be really liberating and it lends clarity to someone's story of their life. And I think then other times it can feel like a trap and you're sort of stuck in this identity as a sick person and the behavior just keeps gaining momentum. And so I was interested in, like, how diagnoses they're not just neutrally reflecting reality. They can also sort of change people's reality too.
Well, you write a lot about, and people have experienced a lot, this kind of divergent path of the two paths of treatment of medication versus talk therapy as a means of addressing a mental illness. And those two paths kind of meet and go into conflict with each other in your first profile, which is about a guy named Ray. Can you tell us about Ray?
Yeah, I knew about his case because it was written in textbooks as this moment where psychoanalysis sort of had its final reckoning and biological psychiatry like triumphed. And Ray was someone who was a doctor who was very depressed, and he checked into this psychoanalytic asylum called Chestnut Lodge, which was like the most elite place to get psychiatric treatment. And patients there would have 4 sessions with their psychoanalysts per week, but like the entire institution was set up to like reflect the ethos of the analyst's office. And Ray just kept getting worse and worse. And his doctors wanted him to like understand, to gain insight into why he was so depressed. And he was like, I just need medication. And they denied him that medication. And finally, after more than half a year, he had lost 40 pounds and was just a completely deteriorated version of himself. And his mother pulled him out of Chestnut Lodge and put him into a hospital where he was given medication. And within 10 days, he sort of like blossomed into like an actual person as opposed to just this destroyed version of himself. And then he was so angry that like he'd been denied that treatment that he sued Chestnut Lodge. And he ended up winning. And the case in like cultural conversations, I think, has been really simplified as the story of this man who was cured by medications and like lived happily ever after. But actually, you know, he was never recovered. Like medications did work, but that story didn't really bear out in his life.
What fascinated you so much about Ray? Why did you want to make sure Ray is in the book and batting leadoff?
I think I wanted to write about him because he represented like these two opposing theories of the mind, like the two dominant frameworks in psychiatry. And for so long, the story of psychiatry has been the story of these two opposing frameworks. And I guess I wanted to like start there, but also move on because it feels like a false way of setting up the problems of psychiatry. And I think like even Ray's own story shows that the psychoanalyst that he wanted revenge against like had a lot of insights into what was causing his suffering that he kind of threw out.
More with Rachel Aviv in just a moment. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
You probably already have a favorite animal. Maybe it's a powerful apex predator like the tiger or a cute and cuddly panda. And those are great, but have you considered something a little more unconventional?
Could I perhaps interest you in the Greenland shark, which can live for nearly 400 years? Or maybe the jewel wasp, who performs brain surgery on cockroaches to control their minds?
On Just the Zoo of Us, we review animals by giving them ratings out of 10 in the categories of effectiveness, ingenuity, and aesthetics. Listen with friends and family of all ages to find your new favorite animal with Just the Zoo of Us on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
Back with New Yorker staff writer Rachel Aviv, author of Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. Let's talk about some of these other characters, and this is where spirituality kind of enters into it, and what is madness versus what is being in touch with God. Tell us about Bapu.
Bapu was a mother and a wife in India, in Chennai, in the late 60s. And she lived in this pretty conservative Brahmin family where she was expected to fulfill her wifely duties in this very specific and sort of controlled way. And she started rebelling against that role, and she would spend more time in her prayer room. And she increasingly developed this extremely intense relationship with Krishna, and she was writing poetry. And at first, her poetry was really celebrated, like it was seen as just a gift. Like, she didn't have training in writing this way, but she was an incredible poet, and even scholars agreed about that. But eventually, the intensity of her devotion was such that she fled home and would like secretly escape and go to healing temples in the south of India. And then her family would try to find her, like the police would bring her back and have her hospitalized and medicated. And for like 10 to 15 years of her life, there was this push-pull between her escaping and feeling like more accepted and tolerated in these healing temples versus her family kind of trying to get her to come back and treat her as someone who had schizophrenia.
Do we need to understand what the truth is with a person like this when we study Bapu? Do we need to say, oh, okay, no, she just had a belief system that was intense and people couldn't handle it, or this is schizophrenia? Or do we just need to accept the ambiguity of her and by extension, lots of other people?
Yeah, I would definitely say you don't need to choose. I mean, one of the things that complicated it for her was like, if there was an American mother who was, you know, in New York City declaring her devotion to Krishna, there almost wouldn't be a choice. It'd be like, oh, that person is mentally ill. Whereas with Bapu, she existed in a cultural context in which that was a fairly socially acceptable thing to do. And so in a way, it was less alienating for her because like there was a community in these healing temples that really believed in what she was saying and accepted who she said she was. And I think that makes it more complicated when there's like cultural reinforcement. But yeah, ultimately, like I think the thing that brought her the most suffering was the sense that in order to pursue like this divine attachment that she had to give up her family. Like she couldn't have both. And later in her life, her children sort of brought her back home and she did take medications and they really helped, but it wasn't as if she gave up her understanding of herself. Like her children allowed her to continue this very like rich, ornate spiritual life, but she wasn't fleeing home anymore because like she was in a space where she was accepted for having these beliefs.
Yeah. I mention on this show sometimes, I try to kind of demystify the term disorder when you're talking about, you know, a major depressive disorder, a social anxiety disorder, how the disorder just refers to being able to live your life in the way you want to live it, you know, making sure that you're clean, making sure that food is on the table for your family, whatever it is. Has your understanding of what a mental illness is and what, you know, what we do with that term of a mental illness or a mental disorder changed over the course of you studying some of these people and writing this book?
I mean, I think I do want to resist. I think there's sometimes this tendency to like romanticize mental illness. And I think like even in Bapu's case, where she was embraced for her poetry and her connection to the divine, like her daughter, you know, saw her, came to see her at a healing temple, and she was like filthy and she was starving and she was sick. And so I think on the one hand, her daughter saw that she had this like radiance and that she was sort of completely captivated by like the work she was doing in terms of her writing, but that like to deny that she was also suffering is to feels naive. So I think something that I have always felt about, you know, when you define disorder is like, is it preventing the person from living the life that they want to live? Like, do they want a family? Do they want to have a job? Like if the illness is getting away from those like very basic capacities, then I don't think we can pretend that there's not like something real there, like a real disability.
Mm. You write about Naomi, and this is one that hit me really close to home because I live in St. Paul where she lived. Can you tell us who Naomi is?
Naomi, so the thing that she became known for was when she was in her early 20s, she was a mother of four, a young Black mother who had grown up in poverty and witnessed a lot of violence and death. And her family had sort of been torn apart by different child welfare agencies. And she became convinced that people were going to take away her children. And she went to the top of a bridge in St. Paul and jumped off with her two twins, and one died and one survived, and she was then put in prison. And one of the complicated things with her story was that, you know, she had sought psychiatric care before this crime, and there was this kind of disconnect where the thing that she was often talking about was she felt like the scales had fallen from her eyes, and she suddenly understood what it meant to be a Black mother in America raising children. Like, she started reading history books and started reading about slavery and sort of seeing these threads of connection between the way that Black people have been treated in America over the last 400 years. And she wanted to talk about these things with her psychiatrists, and, you know, they have limited amount of time, and they would say like, no, you have bipolar disorder, you should take these medications. And the result was that she felt like no one was sort of listening to the thing that was causing her pain. And she felt like invalidated and diminished and sort of did not see psychiatry as an answer. And then later on, when she was in prison and she tried to plead insanity, the people who evaluated her at the hospital essentially said like what she's saying is sociologically true. Like, she's talking a lot about the fear she had about raising Black children in this country. And it was almost like she was having insights about like the state of racism in America that felt too accurate. And they decided that she was competent to stand trial, that like, because she was attributing her decisions to social factors, she was not insane. Like, the things she was saying were true.
Yeah. Like you talk about, she grows up in the Robert Taylor homes in Chicago, mm-hmm. these projects that, you know, you couldn't see grass, you couldn't see trees. You know, walking up 15 flights of stairs because the elevators never worked. Mm-hmm. All these horrible circumstances. And she goes on to do this horrible thing. And the extremity of both the conditions and the extremity of this action that she takes kind of forced me to say like, okay, how much are we shaped by our environment versus how much is this a product of a mental illness? Is this kind of thing inevitable for somebody who's, or at least possible, you know, explainable by somebody who's been through these sorts of things? And I don't know the answer.
Like, there's no answer, but like, yeah, she wouldn't have gotten to that point, like this sort of combination between whatever was going on biologically versus like all the like infinite stressors that had sort of made her feel like there was no possibility of hope, no possibility of having her children have a good life. But I think it was just such a confusing mix for her doctors. Like, she genuinely did have delusions about, you know, government agents coming to get her, but they were grounded in sort of like real facts about what her life had been like and the way that family members had been treated. And I think that made it more confusing for her doctors to like understand what was mental illness and what wasn't, and also made it more difficult for her because she was being told that it was a mental illness, but like all these real things had happened to her that she also wanted to talk about and address.
Yeah, your book, which is a fascinating book, and I really do recommend people read it. And I don't say that about all books, but I've been preaching this to a lot of people.
Were you
trying with these case studies, with Ray, with Bapu, with Naomi, to demonstrate like a central ambiguity? Like, rather than a lot of books saying, I'm going to explain this thing so you'll come away knowing this, mm-hmm. were you trying to say, I'm going to explain this thing so you won't really know what the hell to think of this?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I think like in a way it felt like if there was an argument, it was like an argument against the possibility of one explanation or like one reductive answer. And, you know, at some point in the process of writing the book, I became conscious of and then sort of wanted to emphasize how each chapter sort of complicates or challenges the conclusion someone might have reached in the previous chapter. Yeah, I think that I wanted to draw attention to ways in which when people recovered, it wasn't because they had found like one approach to medicine or psychiatry that had worked. It was often like they were able to hold different explanatory systems in mind at the same time. And sometimes they contradicted, but like they weren't mutually exclusive. It felt like we don't have to choose, kind of. And sometimes it's even seen as like, you know, if you insist you're spiritual, it's seen as like further proof of how deeply mentally ill you are. But I think you don't have to choose. And sometimes in choosing, you diminish someone's sense of who they are. And like that feels like this dangerous thing when an explanation is sort of imposed from on high and you're told that everything you believe and the things that give your life meaning are false. I think that maybe there is not enough attention to how dangerous and destabilizing that can be for someone who's like encountering psychiatry and suddenly being told that like their story of their life has to be like completely rewritten.
We'll take a short break and return with Rachel Aviv.
Hello, I'm a stuffy dowager countess.
Travis?
I'm judging everybody's manners.
Oh, no.
Schmanners isn't judgy. It's about teaching you to be your best self and be a little more confident when you enter social situations that you don't understand, and maybe also teach you a little bit about history you didn't know or give you interesting things to talk about at parties.
Yeah, like the secret life of Emily Post.
Or like why wristwatches are the way that they are.
We can talk about table manners from the Victorian era.
Sure, or what it's like to attend a Regency ball.
Yeah.
You can find all that and more if you listen to Schmanners on Maximum Fun or wherever your podcasts come from, I guess.
Manners, Schmanners. Get it?
Back with author Rachel Aviv. I wonder, I mean, given that all people are complex, all people are complicated, all people are fed by a variety of experiences to get to the point that they are, like nothing comes out of nowhere, everything has a cause. Did you face a challenge in summarizing somebody in, you know, 75 pages? And are we going to be inherently reductionist about their life no matter what we say about them? Because like you take an entire life and then you put it into 75 pages and then I'm telling my wife about the book and I'm putting it into a few sentences what some of these people are about. Like, are we doomed to sell everybody short in terms of their complexity?
When I originally started writing the book, I did think of it as case studies just because I thought that was like an interesting form. And I like the idea of like following one person's life. But as I was reporting it, I came to realize how important people's families were to their stories. And I didn't want to just tell it from the perspective of the individual. I wanted to include different family members, sometimes family members from different generations, friends, community members. So it felt like it was more of a family story. Each story was more of the story of a family and how one person's mental illness has sort of shaped that family story. And something that repeatedly happened was I would like interview one member of the family and their view would be quite different from another member of the family. They did not have the same understanding of what had happened to like their mother, whoever it was. And I tried to kind of preserve that so that in the case of Bapu, her son felt that like she had fundamentally been having a religious experience. And her daughter felt that it was probably more about mental illness. And I wanted to kind of preserve, like, and when I was with her son, I was sort of convinced by his take. And when I was with her daughter, I was convinced by her take. And I wanted to sort of preserve that sense of like, as a reader, you can really understand someone's perspective and sort of hold it as true in the moment and then like shift and suddenly you're not sure anymore and both feel right. So yes, I guess that reinforces my sense of, you know, your question about like, are you always going to simplify if you describe it in a limited number of words? Yes. But I do think including more perspectives works against that a bit.
Do you think that that's something that we can apply to our daily life? You know, you meet somebody at work who you know is going through a depression thing or an anxiety thing. Can we all be Rachel Aviv and find a way of looking at the full complexity of what someone's going through?
I mean, I don't know if I can even do that in my normal life. I do think that something that was so damaging for people that I wrote about was like the sense of being judged. And when they were approached without judgment, it just like allowed for a level of connection that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So maybe, you know, that is one sort of concrete like takeaways is to be able to hear someone's story without judging or classifying or trying to like label it too quickly.
Mm. So the first chapter was about, the first chapter is about you, I guess, but the first mm-hmm. character introduced was Ray, who went mm-hmm. from this talk-only institution to one with medication. And the flip side of that is Laura, who's the final profile in the book, who kind of goes the other way. Introduce us, if you would, to Laura.
Yeah, I think Laura does feel like, you know, where psychiatry goes after the victory of Ray, you know, this sense that like biological psychiatry is the answer. And then Laura was this, she grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut in this extremely like wealthy elite family. And she went to Harvard. She was like a wonderful squash player and student. And she went to McLean and said she was depressed. And very quickly she was diagnosed with a number of medications and she never started to feel better. And so then over the course of like all of her 20s, she was put on more and more medications. And at some point she realized, you know, she'd been on 19 medications over the course of a decade. And she wasn't actually sure that she was any better than she had been when she started. And she also was like no longer sure what her baseline self was because she'd grown up on these medications. And so she decided to slowly go off her medications, in part because she just didn't know who she was without them and she didn't know that they were helping. And then she kind of found a community of other people like grappling with that same question of like how, you know, it's so easy to go on medications, but there is a very little knowledge about how to get off of them and sort of what it does to people.
Mm. And what happens to her over the course of going off of them and does she stay off of them?
Yeah, it's like a really, you know, she finds this community of people who are like, who basically say that withdrawing from medication is such a profound and new experience for some people that like you need new language to describe it. People just use this word neuroemotion to describe what it's like to have this kind of sense that your emotions are synthetic. You're feeling the emotion, but it doesn't feel real in a way. And so she went through this period of almost a year where she was withdrawing from the medications, but having these like very bizarre physical and psychological experiences. And then finally she was off them And her story of it is that she feels much better than she ever has before. I know that that's not like everyone's story. And I think, you know, she, part of what helped is that she found a community of other people who had similar experiences as her. And so she no longer felt so alone. Like, she felt part of a community. And I think for a long time, she didn't have that. And so that was also a component of her recovery.
Are we getting better as a society at accuracy and language and precision when it comes to describing mental illnesses or mental health, I guess, in general?
I think we're getting more free about it. Like, I think there's people talk about it more. There's a lot less like shame about saying that you're depressed. But I don't know that it like always translates into that. I don't know that like talking about it is always translates into feeling better. I think there was this idea that you could reduce stigma by talking about mental illness in a certain way, that if you talked about it as like a brain disease or a chemical imbalance, that would allow people to feel less shame and there'd be less stigma. And there have been studies that show that talking about mental illness that way reduces some kinds of stigma, like you're less likely to blame someone, but it also like increases other kinds of stigma. If you feel like you were just struck by this illness and it's like a biological disease, then there's more of a sense of it being like this essentialist thing that you can't get rid of. It makes you separate and that makes you different. And so I think sometimes seeing mental illness in terms of seeing it as a reflection of your own experiences can also like give you a greater sense of agency.
You write about your own mental health in this book. How has writing and how has examining these people shaped your understanding of your own mental health?
I mean, I don't know if it has.
Really?
I felt like, yeah, I don't know if that was the move to like think about how it reflects on my own mental health. I think it's shaped my understanding of mental health in general, but I don't know that I'm like generating insights about my own life because of it.
Huh. So then how has it shaped your understanding of mental health in general?
Just the like specificity of anyone's, the danger of generalizing in general, how unpredictable it is, like what works and what doesn't, and also how like basic a sense of community and purpose is, how fundamental that is to people's ability to get better and to feel okay. And I think that's not like a technical concept, like loneliness and lack of purpose, but it just felt so central to the story of everyone I was writing about. You know, sometimes psychiatrists could provide people a greater sense of purpose and community, but like often it came from, you know, feeling well enough to seek that out on their own. And I think the relationships that people formed with like other people who had similar experiences, or with, you know, for Naomi, it was like a librarian at her prison who really was a source of connection, or for Bapu, it was her daughter-in-law, but like these moments of connection. And I think maybe that is what therapy does in its ideal form, is create that level of connection and feeling seen. But to me, that felt like the sort of most profound and consistent way that people could like find their bearings and feel like a sense of hope.
The nature versus nurture question. When you look at, you know, somebody has something going on with them, somebody has a mental disorder, or somebody just has some aberrant behavior that is way outside the norm. Is it useful, do you think, to say, okay, is this coming from just what they were born with, a chemical imbalance that they just inherited genetically or biologically, or it's a product of things that have happened in their life? Is that a useful question?
I just don't think it needs to be phrased, is it or is it? You know, like you can have an inquiry about both of those issues without feeling like it's one or the other. I mean, I think like the starting point could be like, yes, of course it's both.
Yeah. And Rachel, you close out the book by revisiting some of the people, or at least one person who you met in that initial hospitalization from when you were six. Tell us about what happened with that.
One of the older girls there was named Hava, and my family was really into her. She was really kind to me. She kind of took me under her wing. We all remembered her being very beautiful. She just stuck in our minds. And when I went back, you know, a few years ago to interview the psychiatrist who treated me at the hospital, I asked about her. And they all became very quiet and like weren't sure whether they would reveal it to me. But finally, they explained that she had just died 6 weeks earlier. And that felt very chastening to me in a way. I mean, I had been thinking about my experience on that anorexia unit as so culturally determined in a way. And to be reminded that for her, for this woman named Hava, like her anorexia had been the defining fact of her life, and it had gained this kind of, it had killed her. It was like she had died because of this life that she'd lived where it sort of deteriorated her body. And so I tried to understand her. She had ended up, she had kept all these journals throughout her life, and her mother allowed me to read them. And I was just sort of wanting to understand. I had felt like she and I had very similar stories when we met, when I was six and she was 12. And I was trying to understand, it felt like she, you know, she could have lived my life or I could have lived her life. And like, what were the differences that like set us off on these different paths in a way? And I've always had this feeling that it's like, there's something arbitrary about, we've both gone through these experiences of mental illness, and like, why for one person does it really define their life and for another person it doesn't? And I think that felt like a central question that like, there is no answer, but I wanted to be aware of how flimsy that boundary can be between like a life that feels normal and one that feels defined by illness.
That's Rachel Aviv. The book is Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. What I like about this book is that the stories of the people Rachel profiles are not tidy stories. They're messy. I like stories, especially true stories, that resist the temptation that I think is always there for a writer to resolve everything and put a bow on it, to make everything nice and neat, even though those stories can be very pleasant to hear. Like with mental health, I could make every episode of this podcast about how someone ran across a problem, they battled it, they had setbacks, and then they conquered it, and they looked back, they're wiser, and they're completely okey-doke. In many ways, stories like that can be reassuring because they allow for daydreams about how, hey, maybe my life could be that tidy. How one day I'll look back and everything that was wrong is now fixed and I'm okay. I think that would be a disservice, though, with mental health and the challenges that it presents. In real life, things aren't tied up in a bow. Issues are rarely solved forever. Mostly, it's just an ongoing mess that we have to manage forever. And I think those stories are maybe more important to tell, even if they wouldn't make for a very good plot in like a Disney movie. I say let's embrace the mess. Let's look across the mess and see other people in their own mess. Let's admit that we have taken up some form of residence within the mess. I'm in the mess too. I'm glad you're here. And our friend Laura House is here with a meditation moment. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
You know, we do a lot of noticing your breath. Laura's going to tell you to notice your breath here in a moment. And I know going to sleep isn't the same thing as meditating, but I've had a lot of success because I have terrible insomnia. I've had a lot of success like, okay, I'm just going to concentrate on this one thing and notice my breath. And it is great about turning the brain not off, but putting it in a lower gear.
Yeah, it's kind of changing the channel, yeah. Right? It's like if I'm paying attention to all my thoughts, which is often sort of worrying, you know, kind of fear-based, you know, sort of thing. I mean, it can be when we're excited and happy, you know, looking forward to something, but it's still, for me, it can come up sort of obsessive, I guess, you know, like
yes.
I just am compulsively in whatever my thought is. And right. It's like we go, oh, we switch over to the breath channel yes. Where there's not as much to really think about. It's just like, oh, I'm always stunned. I've done this for 16 years. How different it feels. Like, oh, my breath. Oh, just noticing it.
Yeah.
makes a difference.
That's been there the whole time?
It's been there the whole time. It's been there all day, for sure.
Yes. It's your oldest friend, by definition.
Yeah, by definition, yeah. We started together.
Let's spend some more time with our old friend here, shall we?
So, just sit comfortably. Chair, sofa, bed where you can be comfortable. Close your eyes. And just notice your breath. That is it. It is happening. So just sort of in your mind, see it, notice it in your body. And you'll have thoughts. And your mind will sort of notice the breath and then kind of keep wandering over to your thoughts, just completely natural. And when you have this awareness, you just kind of look back at your breath. Easily. And just let go. Go ahead and open your eyes.
You know, the nice thing about having those thoughts and then kind of getting distracted and then having to get back to it, you didn't miss anything. There wasn't like a key plot point or anything that you missed out on.
Yeah, no, that is such a good point, because it's inherently we feel like we're about to break through or figure something out, but it's like, no, we're just, I've heard something crazy like, we think about 100,000 thoughts a day, and they're 80% the same thoughts we had yesterday.
Yes.
So detouring from them is not going to hurt you.
Yeah, slowing down at least is good. You can hear Laura on Tiny Victories, which is a wonderful podcast here on Maximum Fun. You can also find her on internet at laurahouse.com. Laura, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Next time on Depression Mode, Ellen is a cartoonist, and she likes drawing this little monster who also happens to be a mnemonic device for self-care. The monster's name is Smedmertz.
So this little monster, this Smedmertz, an acronym for sleep, meds, eat, doctor, mindfulness, meditation, exercise, routine, tools like coping tools, and support system. It's kind of spokes on a wheel, like they all work together. And you might notice that meds is only one spoke. You can look at a study that shows that nutrition has a huge impact on your mental health. And sleep, you know, like a study about sleep, huge impact on your mental health. Look at any of these things and realize that they're all really important and they all work together.
Cartoonist Ellen Forney joins us. Hey, our merchandise shop is open and it's full of some wonderful things. T-shirts and hoodies and beanies and blankets. We got blankets. And a lot of these things say, I'm glad you're here on them. They have the Depression Mode logo on them, but we really leaned hard into I'm glad you're here because, one, it's something that I say on every show. This week I said it twice. And two, it's just a good sentiment, I think, to put out in the world. Promoting the show is great. But I think putting out the idea that I'm glad you're here, something that you can say to other people with this merchandise, or something that you can say to yourself by wearing it in a t-shirt form. We also have the Depression Mode sweatpants, because honestly, people like us, sometimes we just need to wear sweatpants. That shop is available at maxfunstore.com. So stop by. Everything you purchase there helps support the show. So you're not just getting some cool stuff. You're not just sending out the sentiment that I'm glad you're here. You're helping this show. You're helping us continue to make new episodes. Everybody wins. If people support our show, We can keep making new shows. If that support dries up, so do we. Let's not dry up. Let's stay healthy. Let's thrive. Another way that you can join the show, you can donate to the show, make us even stronger, is by going to MaximumFun.org/join. So MaxFunStore.com for the merch store, MaximumFun.org/join to join the show. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. All of that really helps us as well. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 for free in the United States by calling 988. That's all you need to do. Just dial 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741741. Our electric mail address is depreshmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies, and send in a request and we'll let you in and you'll be a part of some wonderful discussions with some really great people. I'm on Twitter @JohnMo. As long as there is a Twitter, I'll be there. Hi, credits listeners. The part in the Monkees theme song that always bothered me is "We're too busy singing to put anybody down." Because, like, if their recording schedule was lighter, would they just be running around insulting people? Are the Monkees secretly cruel, but someone's just keeping them occupied? Did Peter Tork wish to rip me to shreds verbally? I lose sleep about this to this day. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, and we get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hello, this is Nath from Tacoma, Washington, and I'm glad you're here.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.